Thank you, Ovier. So addressing the public goods that underlie health requires a collective rights framework, I'll argue. And I find that the collective right to development provides this framework for public health, a framework for realizing rights to health during the course of development. So good morning, I'm Benjamin Meyer, and I'm going to open this session with a somewhat lengthy presentation, arguing that public health should embrace this effort and employ the right to development in arguing for equitable poverty alleviation for the public's health, doing so through public health systems for the protection of health as part of the development agenda. I'm an assistant professor of global health policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I work at the intersection of international law, public policy, and global health. I'm also a scholar at the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University. And most important to this conversation, I am a member in good standing, I hope, with the International Human Rights Committee of APHA. And so we designed this framework in order to think about how the right to development and the Millennium Development Goals contribute to the public's health. And so I'll be beginning by thinking about what has happened in the two decades since structural adjustment programs began, when they were first implemented, arguing that these structural adjustment programs have decimated fragile health and social infrastructures in countries throughout Africa and Latin America, leaving people poorer and less healthy. And I find through these overlapping multiple processes, disadvantaged populations have suffered acute burdens of globalization. And so the Washington Consensus has largely been instrumental in determining the health and the fate of individuals and the public's health. I argue that it has done so by negatively affecting fundamental determinants of disease, risk, health vulnerability, and the government's response through public health systems. And so the question is, how can we correct for this, and what role do human rights have to play in that response? And so I'll be here talking about recognizing that globalization harms health at a societal level, at a national level, disproportionately affecting vulnerable populations independent of individual choice, and then arguing thereafter that collective rights, specifically focusing on a collective right to development, has the ability to redress these socially created inequities through underlying determinants of health. And so rather than simply focusing on individual rights to health, we need to expand our discussion to collective rights, using collective rights like the right to development and others to combat the insalubrious inequities of a globalized world. And so in thinking about this presentation, I'm going to structure this and the discussion that follows by trying to justify the inclusion of public health advocates in debates concerning economic development. In this context, we'll discuss the background of the health and human rights movement, how international human rights law shapes health at an individual and a societal level. I'll discuss the history, thinking about how current development policies have failed to improve both economic and health equality, often leading to deteriorating health conditions. I'll contemplate how human rights principles can be applied to economic growth in constructing health-conscious development, thinking about this through both a rights-based approach to development and a right to development. And then finally, to get this conversation started, I'll turn it over to Elvira, who will pick up where I leave off, discussing how the Millennium Development Goals seek to address the issue of poverty and how these relate to health. And so, as I mentioned, this conversation is going to focus on human rights under international law as a tool for public health. And this is largely where the health and human rights movement lies. And so in this context, international human rights law offers a powerful policy discourse, as framing health disparities as rights violations offers international standards by which to frame governmental responsibilities and evaluate conduct under law, shifting the analysis from one of social justice to one of legal enforcement. And so in the context of human rights as an integral part of the international legal framework, we'll be discussing primarily the UN Charter of 1945 and the many UN treaties and declarations that have come out of the UN process subsequent to the Second World War. And so under this rights-based approach, International law seeks to identify rights holders and their entitlements, and corresponding duty bearers and their obligations. As such, we can view human rights as that which a person is entitled to have, or do, or to receive from others, and which is also enforceable by law. And so philosophically, this is posited as X has a right against Y in relation to Z, where X is the rights holder, Y is the duty bearer, and Z is the object or the end of that right. And so rather than thinking about this in the abstract, I've included an example here, which gives an accurate description of how the rights paradigm operates, whereby we find that a woman as a rights holder has a valid claim to a right to health, the object of that right, which is realized through the duties of the national government, the duty bearer, to provide HIV treatment. And this is the line of reasoning that we see most often. And so in this case, there's a demand on the duty bearer to respect, protect, and fulfill a particular right, with this right realized through programs involving, among other options, law reforms, budget allocations, or program evaluations. And so from a social justice perspective, this is about empowerment, that through human rights advocacy, power is transferred from the duty bearer, who has a legal responsibility to develop access to that right, and from that duty bearer to a rights holder, who is entitled to that right rather than being the passive recipient of a charitable donation. Thus, we find that the object of a health and human rights movement, of health and human rights organizations, is to define these duty bearers and rights holders, to impose legal obligations on duty bearers through social justice, legislative, litigation means, and then finally to inform rights holders of their rights and how these rights can be claimed and enforced. And I need to reiterate at the outset, before going on to the evolution of rights, that human rights matter, that what is written into international law has an effect on state behavior. We think about this most forcefully in the paradigmatic institution of slavery, that what was once a common economic practice throughout the world through a series of international legal prohibitions was swept nearly entirely from the world. And so it's not simply that there were international legal standards, but the language of those international legal standards became increasingly more specific and increasingly more universal, inalienable. And so the legal language matters. That anchoring health policy and human rights standards is more than simply aspirational. That these standards, the words of the international laws, have practical implications for the way state and global policy is carried out. Secondly, I need to note that human rights evolve. They didn't come from God. Sorry to disappoint. These were things that were written into law by representatives of states. Their norms, their ideas that then become codified or put into law. And so recognizing that these are norms written into law by individuals, we can say that these norms evolve, that our understanding of what constitutes a human right changes over time, and that we can look to these international legal standards to understand this progression of law. And so with the health and human rights movement now understood to offer a framework for health policy, the enforcement of such rights is explicitly shaped by human rights principles, framing the legal and policy environment, systematically integrating core principles into policy and programming, and evaluating how policies and programs are carried out through rights-based policy. And so in thinking about development, we need to ask, why are we here? This topic might seem to a lot of people as somewhat removed from the health issues normally discussed through the American Public Health Association. You might rightly ask, why should economic and poverty issues be discussed within the context of public health? Shouldn't these economic issues be left to economists? Nevertheless, we feel that these are important and that public health should have a seat at the development table, arguing here that a commitment to health necessarily implies a commitment to reducing poverty. As Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General in the United Nations, noted, the biggest enemy of health in the developing world is poverty. If poverty underlies health, then shouldn't health have a place in this discussion? While this idea is true in the abstract, we'll need to understand what value public health advocates have, what value public health practitioners can make in reducing poverty as a means of improving health. And if so, what role human rights can play in that effort? So we begin by asking, what is the global picture of poverty? We begin with a definition. What is poverty to begin with? For the purpose of this discussion, we'll say that poverty is a lack of basic necessities, essential goods, services, systems. These essential necessities that all human beings must have. Food and water, shelter, education, medical care, security. This is obviously a multidimensional issue, and that poverty exceeds all social, economic, and political boundaries. As such, efforts to alleviate poverty must be informed by a variety of factors, and we'll discuss what role human rights plays in delineating those factors. And so when we think about poverty throughout the world, we recognize that 1.2 billion individuals currently live on less than $1 a day, what we refer to as absolute poverty. And among these impoverished in developing countries, 60% lack basic sanitation, half of whom have no access to safe water. And that from these impoverished environments, 28,000 children die each day from poverty-related causes. So recognizing that poverty has an effect on ill health, but also noting that it's a cyclical relationship, that ill health has an effect on poverty, or has a detrimental effect on economic development. The ends determine the means. What is the goal that we're trying to achieve here? Are we trying to alleviate health, to alleviate poverty? Or do we seek to alleviate poverty in order to improve health? And I'll argue in this context that the second, the latter, alleviating poverty as a means to improve health, is in greater concordance with human rights. And so this exacerbation of global poverty is obviously expanded by widening of global inequalities. Yes, this was a shameless ploy to add Bono to a slide. Thinking about inequality, we know that the gap between the rich and poor is as important in many respects as poverty is, because we know that poverty, that the impoverishment of entire societies is disproportionately shared across the world. So we need to ask, what's so bad about inequality? Why is relative poverty just as bad as absolute poverty? And in so doing, we understand how we go from inequality, a difference among groups, to what is referred to as inequity, a difference among groups that is thought to be unjust. And so, given these effects of poverty, inequality, we need to ask what's causing it all. And in this context, we need to ask what the health implications of globalization are. And by globalization, I'm referring to the increased interconnectedness between countries, increases in trade, monetary policy, and also the global spread of human rights norms. So we need to ask, is globalization good for health? Modernization has obviously led to many improvements in health, the creation of medical technologies and the dissemination of those technologies throughout the world. But I'll argue also that globalization has served to exacerbate disparities in health between rich and poor. And in considering these disparities, it's important to look at disparities rather than simply averages. Rather than accepting aggregate data, GDP, at a national level, that this might be unsuited to trying to understand improvements at a national level for health. And so we need to focus on exacerbations of inequalities in health, not simply average levels of development. And so as noted by former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Paul Hunt, he says that, quote, from a human rights perspective, the average condition of the whole population is unhelpful and can even be misleading. improvement in average health indicators may actually mask a decline for some marginal groups. And so recognizing that national level development indicators are inadequate to the task of understanding social justice in health through development, we need to understand how we make this case for an integration of a human right to development with health. And so we can recognize that inequitable development affects health at a global level. But we also need to understand the relationship between development and health. How do these broad global processes affect health at an individual level? And so how do we think about the persistence of absolute poverty and its attendant maladies for the billions around the world for whom this takes place? How do we think about countries' failure to provide for the health of their peoples in the context of development? And so in this context, the ecological model of public health has become the focus of those seeking to improve health indicators through economic development, emphasizing social inequalities rather than individual health services as the basis of health. And so drawing on centuries of research in social medicine, the ecological model of health has led researchers to examine underlying determinants of health as a mechanism through which poverty leads to detrimental health outcomes. Thus, it's become a maxim of public health played out in many settings that no matter the disease or from where it originates, it will inevitably descend the social gradient to become a disease of the poor. And so through this appreciation of broader social conditions that structure health, the ecological model implicates collective responsibility for unhealthy behaviors, unhealthy norms, unhealthy conditions, with public health practitioners examining structural determinants of health, including the way society organizes itself, interacts with the natural environment, and structures social relations. And so given this link between poverty and damage to underlying determinants of health, health scholars have long held that economic development would lead inexorably to improve conditions for the public's health, noting the positive relation between GDP at the national level and rising life expectancies at the national level. Recognizing that poverty is a source of individual health harm, how can we use development to improve health? However, in the context of examining underlying determinants of health, it becomes clear that simply alleviating poverty will not improve health, that there are social, cultural, political, and material changes that accompany the development process, not simply growth itself, that are the causal agents that are vital for the provision of public goods, for public health systems. And it's these societal processes that are truly responsible for the reduction of morbidity and mortality. And yet these are not the changes that are pursued by international economic institutions, which will argue entrench poverty rather than alleviating poverty for the improvement of health. And they do so by dictating to poor countries how they should run their country, which is a harsh way of saying that through fundamental free market ideology, through rapid trade liberalization, rapid financial liberalization, through the restructuring of states, international economic institutions, chief among them the IMF, seek to create a light state. Oops, forgot a second quotation there. A light state, allowing states to grow at a national level in order to repay the loans that they've taken out over the last 40 years. And in order to create a system by which the state can repay its loans, the IMF seeks to restructure states, to privatize what were once state functions, to reduce government spending, to free up government resources that can be better spent on loan repayments. And yet we find that this reduction of the state, this light state, has led to both an exacerbation of absolute poverty and a profoundly negative effect on health. As these neoliberal development policies, as they're called, either increase the number of people living in absolute poverty or weaken public health systems through this process of lightening up the state. And so as a result, developing countries continue to experience high rates of infectious disease, shortened lifespan, diminished quality of life, generating vast ecological rifts between rich and poor countries. And so rather than this goal of development at the absolute level, the goal has become to create sustainable development. Development that is useful in spurring the state on. Such as it is, it really does make the point, doesn't it? Such as it is that the Earth Summit in 1992 said that what we're trying to find is not economic development, but development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Or as the Organization of American States has noted, within a country, gradual change characterized by economic growth, including increased social equity, the constructive modification of ecosystems, and the maintenance of a natural resource base. So focusing on development as a holistic process that takes place not simply at an economic level, but at a political level and at a social level. And so we ask, how can human rights account for these underlying determinants of health and create sustainable development? And I've limited it to three underlying determinants of health through the lens of human rights here, but I could have gone on and on. And so we recognize that in the context of housing, that inadequate housing and sanitation plague impoverished urban communities throughout the developing world. And along those lines, in considering safe migration, we know that individuals from rural areas are hoping to find employment, seeking escape from famine, drought, civil strife, are migrating to urban centers that are being designed to facilitate loan repayments. And yet these urban centers lack the infrastructures to support such massive influxes. And then finally, we can think about healthcare, both at an individual level and at a societal level. At an individual level, we know that disadvantaged or impoverished individuals often find themselves unable to access skilled medical care, with a lack of medical knowledge, high physician expenses, geographic disenfranchisement, all limiting treatment options. We also know at a societal level, as we discussed, structural adjustment at the national level, poverty reduction programs have crippled public health systems, leaving people without access to systems for clean water, systems for clean air, systems to the many structures of the built environment that we know underlie health. And so addressing this through human rights, there's a fundamental debate that continues in the development literature. What is the human right that we're trying to protect? We begin by noting that poverty itself is not a violation of human rights. This is the oft-repeated phrase in all UN documents. So what's the problem if poverty itself isn't a violation of human rights? And this constructs the way health and human rights activists interact in the context of development. Are they trying to achieve rights-based development? Thinking about human rights, many human rights, as a response to globalization and development? Or are we thinking about development itself as a human right? And if development itself is a human right, how does this right at a national level with a national rights holder interact with the many individual rights that exist in the current environment? And so considering this idea that poverty, inequality, links itself to health through a multitude of overlapping human rights violations, we begin by considering this rights-based approach to development, which seeks to institutionalize human rights in all health sector actions, acknowledging that the poor are marginalized in all health decisions. We seek to incorporate individuals in health decision-making through the development process. We also seek to strengthen and extend public health functions, healthcare and beyond, that create the basic conditions that are necessary to achieve health and escape poverty. By that, I'm referring to underlying determinants of health that we've discussed. And so we need to ask, how can public health address underlying determinants of health through human rights? And I've noted that this is largely focused on equitable financing of healthcare. That what a rights-based approach to development seeks to do in the context of health is to increase access to health for the poor and for the near poor, which requires, as I've noted here, that resources be pooled for those members of society who are healthy and for those who are not healthy, what we think of as a national healthcare system. It's something that exists in other places, trust me. And yet we know that this hasn't worked, that a rights-based approach to development has not succeeded. I argue that it's not succeeded because there's a failure of the individual right to health to account for damages to the public's health, that an individual right to health cannot address harms to health that occur not at the individual level, but that occur at the societal, the population, at the national level. And so employing a framework of rights-based approaches to development, public health scholars who have attempted to impose the individual right to health on states in the injurious aftermath of development policy implementation have largely failed, because this has been ineffective in altering what is in fact the underlying determinant of health. That a right to health has been ineffective because it hasn't addressed the formulation of the development policy itself. It has been responsive to development policy, but not tried to change that development policy, thus marginalizing voices of public health in development debates. And so, based largely on this individualistic framing, the common interpretation of a right to health as an individual right to treatment more often than not, has failed to address those aspects of public health that can only be achieved by the provision of public goods through public health systems. Because the right has been advanced as an individual right to be realized by a state duty bearer, this limited and somewhat atomized right has proven insufficient to create accountability for international obligations in global health, leaving in its wake deteriorating national health systems that lack the ability to address a widening set of public health claims. As such, national enforcement of a right to health has been limited in challenging the global institutional arrangements that structure the ability of states through primary health care systems. I've asked, what is sovereignty in a globalized world? How do we think about state responsibility for individual human rights, when the idea of human rights, the idea of presupposing a tyrannical state, no longer exists? What do we do when a state isn't realizing rights, not because it hates people, but because it simply can't given its current financial resources? And so now, with large proportions of health-related funding flowing through foreign assistance programs, the growing chasm between international power and domestic responsibility and health rights highlights the utility of collective health rights, rights of states, rights of peoples, that can reform international institutions, that can account for international obligations to realize primary health care. And so for rights scholars to advance disease protection and health promotion through national primary health care systems, codifying in law the international legal obligations necessary to spur development, but to spur development supportive of the public's health, I argue that they need to look beyond individual rights to develop collective rights that are commensurate with a public health-centered approach to realizing underlying determinants of health. And so in thinking about collective rights as being necessary to realize global public goods, I find that with global health determinants implicating collective international responsibility for global health, collective rights become necessary to address these international obligations for global public goods. That when we're talking about public health, we're talking about a shared public good, a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts. That health can be given at a societal level, not to a group of individuals. That what we need to look to is primary healthcare systems, and that these primary healthcare systems are what are necessary to lead to positive externalities, or in this case, health for all. And so it's at the international level where the ability of states to realize public health through primary healthcare systems is constrained by the international development paradigm. Correspondingly, it's also at this international level where implementation of collective rights can enable a restructuring of international institutions, allowing developing states to enter international development debates with a right of cooperation, a right of cooperation from the international community, not simply a plea for charity. And so although human rights were initially conceived following the Second World War as individual rights, with collective rights thought to be one of the causes of the German invasion of the Sudetenland, it was thought of that individual rights, an individual rights bearer, making claims against a national duty bearer, a presumptively tyrannical national duty bearer, would give rise to a world without war. Putting aside the idea that this world without war didn't really come to pass, the rise of developing states in international relations and development debates in the 1960s and 1970s led to a reconceptualization, a reexamination of this individual conception of human rights. And so recognizing that most developing states were not around, were still under the binds of their colonial masters when the United Nations was created and declared its Universal Declaration of Human Rights, these developing states, rising in international relations, taking seats at the United Nations, would move in the 1960s and 1970s through a non-aligned movement, a grouping of developing countries in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, those who didn't take part in the original drafting of human rights, those states for whom neo-colonization through development paradigms was a reality, that they would seek to advance a new vision of human rights. And so viewing traditional human rights frameworks as an extension of imperialist domination, developing states sought to advance collective rights as a means of freeing people from the neo-colonial binds of international relations and establishing a new international economic order, often referred to as third-generation rights, a rhetorical remnant of Cold War topologies, thinking of first-generation rights as those civil and political rights in the U.S. Bill of Rights, second-generation rights being all those economic, social, and cultural rights advanced by the Second World in the Soviet Union, and third-generation rights being those lesser rights advanced by the developing world to address the problems of the Third World. And so, often referred to as third-generation rights, collective rights would seek to operate at an international level to assure public benefits that can only be enjoyed in common with similarly situated individuals, and thus cannot be realized through individual human rights claims against the state. And so rather than seeking to restrain the state, as most human rights do, recognizing that restraint of the state was a simplistic an inadequate obligation for states struggling to provide for the health of their peoples in a globalizing world. These collective rights would seek to empower the state to realize rights outside of their control. And so out of this process, states developed a UN Declaration on the Right to Development in 1986, creating within it a holistic view of development, using human rights standards in Article 1 to define the right as an inalienable right by virtue of which every human person and all peoples are entitled to participate in, contribute to, and enjoy economic, social, cultural, and political development, in which all human rights and fundamental freedoms can be fully realized. And so this largely views, as I've noted here, a right to development as a composite right. It's not simply the sum of all human rights. It is a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. And so if one right, one of the constituent rights of this interconnected whole are violated, all human rights are violated. And so this requires not only sufficient resources for development at a national level, but that that development be put toward the realization of human rights. Doing so is an explicit response to globalization, that this was put forward specifically to reduce inequities in international trade, differential access to technologies, and to forgive these neo-colonial debts that were burdening developing countries and realizing development. This was then brought to the fore of human rights in 1993 in the Vienna Declaration and Program of Action. At the end of the Cold War, all countries came together in the spirit of unity in a rare signal of U.S. support for human rights and development, whereby states would declare that a right to development is a universal and inalienable right and an integral part of human rights. And yet, in the same declaration, the U.S. would add language arguing that states shall not use this right in order to infringe on other rights, noting that the lack of development may not be invoked to justify the abridgment of other human rights. This is based upon the idea that the U.S. is not looking at the right to development as a supreme or a preeminent right, that development should not be used as the basis for restricting civil and political rights or restricting other economic, social, and cultural rights, that what we should be looking toward is not simply a right to development, but a right to the opportunity to develop. And so moving forward from this, this would reconceptualize the development debate, that rather than simply seeking growth at a national level in economic terms, we would begin to talk about human development, equitable development, measuring growth not simply on the basis of dollars and cents, but on the basis of the human lives that are improved. Such it is that I argue that the right to development offers a legal framework by which to restructure institutions to meet global justice imperatives. Global justice imperatives for public health, for global health. And so working through this vector of rights and duties, these collective rights can address interconnected determinants of health within and across countries, obligating states and the international community to scale up primary healthcare systems and thereby reduce inequities in global health. And so in framing these international obligations, the duty bearer for the right to development would be the international community, including individual states, yes, but also including international organizations, public-private partnerships, and going so far as to consider the mega philanthropies that have now become, in many respects, the largest force in global health. And so at this international level, developing states could operationalize collective rights to enforce global public health commitments, to channel foreign assistance toward primary healthcare systems, and to ensure cooperation in international institutions for global health. And so as depicted in this schematic here, which is probably too small for anyone to read, it's in an article somewhere that I've written. Whereas the international right to health can only be invoked by individuals against the state, as depicted on the left side of the screen in rights-based development, the collective right development can be invoked both at a state level and against the international community. Thus, we can see that a right to development can be used to promote and protect public goods, such as national primary health care systems. Protecting national primary health care systems against development processes that would otherwise harm the development of public goods for health. And so we'll get over that. And say, since the ability of states to realize their individual human rights obligations domestically is constrained by the actions and institutional arrangements of the international community, realizing a human right to development will require restructuring of international institutions and national foreign assistance programs, allowing developing states to enter public health debates with this right of assistance and cooperation that is so often invoked in human rights, but so rarely realized. And so collective rights can be implemented through both international and intranational means. Internationally, collective rights can be implemented to restructure existing international institutions and incorporate human rights clauses into the international legal structure of these institutions. Thus, I've included not only the World Trade Organization, but the World Health Organization's logo at the bottom, because I believe that to ensure that health assistance is channeled into projects that strengthen primary health care systems, there needs to be coordination through a central body such as WHO to reduce redundancy in contributions, reduce redundancy in efforts, and to coordinate the international donors that fund global health. Intranationally, within countries, to address the domestic sources of global health inequalities, differential levels of state capacity, and structural arrangements that reinforce a dependence on developing countries on overseas development assistance need to be restructured such that collective rights can be implemented to ensure that both bilateral and multilateral assistance is channeled through general budgetary support and sector-wide approaches to primary healthcare systems. And so whereas current public health assistance tends to crowd out the public sector, to crowd out the state, while targeting programs vertically toward particular high-profile diseases, diseases that many of us work on, but at the same time create distortions in national health policy, instead of this general budgetary support would overcome these bottlenecks in donor-driven priority settings by providing developing states with greater autonomy in addressing national public health priorities through official needs assessments of the public health system. Thus, collective rights would provide a legal framework for states to seek or provide international assistance and cooperation in accordance with states' respective capabilities, with a massive influx of funds going toward health and health-related development projects. It's more critical than ever that this health assistance be coordinated to meet international public health goals and be employed to strengthen national primary health care systems. Such an approach would allow states to reshape the international community, to reshape it for health promotion, to raise international public health obligations during economic development planning, and to increase national resources to realize primary health care for all. And so I find at the end that the right to development can address these collective processes of national development, providing a framework for increasing available resources, easing budgetary constraints, and providing equitably for underlying determinants of health at a national level, And so transcending the right to health's focus on the individual, the collective right to development, as a vector of rights, offers us as the public health community an opportunity to work through international development discourses, to empower states to allocate public goods for the public's health, realizing underlying determinants of health through national public health systems. I began by discussing the harms of globalization, the social transformations inherent in globalization have changed the world, and they necessitate an evolving conception of human rights. I find that the collective right to development offers a collective means by which to best serve the goals of public health. Because health equity, at the end of the day, can't only be concerned with health, seen in isolation. Rather, it must come to grips with larger issues of fairness, of justice, and social arrangements, including economic allocations and social structures, paying appropriate attention to the role of health in life, in justice, and in freedom. And so this is the process that's taken up by which human rights are translated into global policy. And so I'm going to turn it over to Elvira to discuss how this policy has been constructed through the Millennium Development Goals. Thank you.